Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Thea Lee, AFL-CIO Policy Director, who talks about the union movement's priorities for addressing the nation's financial crises. Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun Magazine, who explains why he is troubled by President-elect Barack Obama's appointment of Rahm Emanuel as his White House Chief of Staff. And Manning Marable, professor of political science and African American studies at Columbia University, who examines the historic nature of Barack Obama's election and the difficult work ahead for the progressive coalition that put him into office. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Over 250,000 people in the war-torn eastern half of the Democratic Republic of the Congo, or DRC, have fled their homes in recent weeks as fighting raged between the Congolese army and rebel commander General Laurent Nkunda. United Nations envoy Olusegun Obasanjo, the former president of Nigeria, met with Nkunda in mid-November. Since starting an offensive in August, Nkunda has nearly doubled the territory he controls as he has become a champion for ethnic Tutsis near the district capital of Goma. Congo's president, Joseph Kabila, has refused to negotiate directly with Nkunda, nor does the government have the power to expel various militias from the eastern Congo. There is growing fear that the current wave of fighting will reignite Congo's brutal civil war of the 1990s, in which troops from surrounding nations like Rwanda, Uganda, and Zimbabwe occupied Congolese territory. In recent days, the BBC has received reports of Angolan troops aiding the Congolese army in Goma. It is estimated that Nkunda has 6,000 soldiers in eastern Congo, which rivals the size of the UN peacekeeping force in the region. In the midst of passing the $700 billion bailout package in Congress, the U.S. Treasury Department revised an obscure provision of the tax code, Section 382, which gives American banks a tax windfall of up to $140 billion. According to the Washington Post, the source of the controversy relates to how tax shelters are treated in corporate mergers. The tax change had an immediate impact as Wells Fargo revived its takeover bid for Wachovia. Having successfully outbid Citigroup for the failing bank, the tax change may reduce Wells Fargo's tax liability by $25 billion. Many congressional staffers and independent tax lawyers say the Treasury Department acted illegally by making a unilateral change in the tax code. In early October, senior congressional staffers held a secret conference call with the Treasury's top tax official, Eric Solomon, seeking answers about the tax revision. But key politicians like Senator Max Baucus, chairman of the Senate Finance Committee, wanted to keep the dispute quiet out of a concern of disrupting any pending bank merger. Tax analysts say the fear of open criticism is similar to what happened in Congress after the September 11th terrorist attacks, when Democrats were afraid to openly criticize the Patriot Act. As tax attorney Lee Shepard observed, "We're left with congressional Democrats who have the spine of overcooked spaghetti." State governments are clamping down on the rising use of antipsychotic drugs like Zyprexa for chronic diseases, whose use has increased 12 times since the year 2000. Now, these drugs have been linked to negative side effects like weight gain and higher cholesterol levels. In March, the state of Alaska won a $15 million settlement with the Eli Lilly Company to recover costs from Medicaid patients who developed diabetes while taking Zyprexa. According to the online news site Alternet, other states like Idaho, Washington, Connecticut, South Carolina, and Texas are taking Big Pharma to court, declaring that antipsychotic medications did more harm than good with some patients. The increased use of antipsychotic drugs among elderly patients has resulted in more cases of diabetes, higher suicide risk, and more cases of leukopenia. Food and Drug Administration safety expert Dr. David Graham told Congress last year that secondary use of antipsychotic drugs for dementia caused approximately 15,000 deaths annually. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruben Abreu. We'll be right back.
As Barack Obama prepares to become the nation's next president in January, the country he'll govern faces multiple economic crises, including the Wall Street financial meltdown, the subprime mortgage disaster, a growing recession with rising unemployment, and the prospect that one or more major U.S. car companies could fail. So far, the Treasury Department has allocated $158.56 billion to 30 banks as part of the $700 billion bailout program designed to boost the nation's financial and credit systems. The original plan approved by Congress to fund the purchase of so-called toxic mortgage assets has been set aside. But there is growing pressure from lawmakers and the public to get more direct help to struggling homeowners who face foreclosure. The number of homeowners facing foreclosures across the country grew by 25% from October 2007 to the same month this year. As Congress wraps up their last session before newly elected members take office in January, Democrats are proposing a $100 billion economic stimulus plan that would provide funds to rebuild the nation's infrastructure, assist state governments, and allocate $25 billion in loans to the auto industry. Although General Motors has reported that it may run out of cash early next year, all three major U.S. automakers are in trouble. Together with their suppliers, they employ 2.5 million workers, nearly 2% of the nation's workforce. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Thea Lee, AFL-CIO Policy Director, who talks about the nation's largest labor federation's priorities for addressing the U.S. financial crises.
Well, it certainly is a daunting set of challenges that our incoming president will face. And, you know, the top priority for us is certainly to get the economy back on track. And it doesn't look like the Congress is going to be able to get too much done in the lame duck session. And so that means in January of 2009, it's going to be very urgent that the Congress and the president act together quickly to create some energy in this economy, create some jobs. And we're looking at a very substantial economic recovery package that we think needs to be done on the order of $300 to $400 billion. So it's really a large package. It would include unemployment insurance, new spending for infrastructure and clean energy, as well as aid to state and local governments. And those are all what we think the quickest way of getting the money back into the economy and getting some jobs created. And of course, the aid to the auto industry is crucial as well.
Now, with tax revenue going down and the government in deeper and deeper deficit over many years with the Iraq War piling up lots of debt, should there be a concern about, adding to that deficit, spending billions or trillions of dollars more to invest in infrastructure? Do you think one offsets the other?
Well, certainly we need to think about the medium and the long term, how we are going to close that budget deficit. I think in the short term, it's should be a priority to get the economy going again. But we do need to figure out how we can bring revenues and expenditures closer together, and that is something important. I think President-elect Obama has talked about the need to pull back the Bush tax cuts for the very wealthy, and that goes a certain distance. Then also, of course, bringing the Iraq War to an end, eventually that will bring some money home. But, I mean, I think one of the distinctions that we need to think about also is thinking about the budget spending as the difference between consumption and investment. If we are investing in the future, we are, rebuilding the economy to the point where we'll be more productive and people will be able to pay higher taxes in the future. If we just toss the money away, if we give people tax cuts to go to the mall and buy another DVD player, then we're not investing in the future productivity of the U.S. economy. And so we do need to make a distinction between those two kinds of spending, consumption versus investment.
One of the features of the U.S. economy over the last couple of decades, at least, is growing income inequality, stagnating wages, the inability of middle-class families to pay for health care, to pay for college tuition, and some of the basics are going by the wayside. People are, of course, had mortgaged their houses several times in order to get the money to do these things for their kids and themselves. But when it comes to income inequality, Thea Lee, what kinds of issues and solutions are you thinking about at the AFL-CIO?
Well, that's an excellent question. I think you're getting right to the heart of the problem, which is one of the reasons we're in this economic mess right now is that we've been trying to juice our economy, a consumer-driven economy, by busting unions and globalizing and driving wages down and inequality higher, and people don't have the money at the end of the day to go buy the stuff. And so people were making up for the fact that their wages and their income weren't really keeping up with inflation by spending more money through consumer debt, through their credit cards, or borrowing money on the value of their homes. And so debt was really substituting for wages and income over the last decade or so. And that was a dangerous place to be. So we do think that that's really important, that we redress the inequality of this economy. The key thing for us is the Employee Free Choice Act, which is labor law reform, to make it easier for workers to join a union. And we think that that will help rebalance bargaining power in the economy so that workers can bargain for their fair share of the wealth that they create. And that will help strengthen the middle class. And that, in fact, is good for the economy at a moment like this. What we need to do is to strengthen people's purchasing power to rebuild our middle class. And so we think that the Employee Free Choice Act is actually very timely, even as we are in a deep recession.
That was Thea Lee, AFL-CIO Policy Director. Call the Union Federation at area code 202-637-5000 or visit their website at aflcio.org. One of President-elect Barack Obama's first appointments was his close friend, Illinois Congressman Rahm Emanuel, to serve as his chief of staff. Much has been written about Emanuel's hardline, take-no-prisoners, super-partisan political style, leading some to conclude that he will play bad cop to Obama's good cop in dealing with Congress. As head of the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee for the 2006 election, Emanuel supported many conservative Democrats over more liberal anti-war candidates because he thought they had the best chance of winning. But once in Congress, many of these representatives disappointed anti-war Americans who expected a Democratic-led Congress to take a tougher stand on ending President Bush's Iraq War. Emanuel, a hawkish supporter of Israel, worked as a volunteer in the Jewish state during the first Gulf War. His father, a pediatrician who grew up in Israel and later emigrated to the U.S., belonged to the Israeli militant group Irgun before independence in 1948. As chief of staff, Emanuel will have the ear of President Obama and serve as his gatekeeper. Between the Lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine and chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives, about an email he recently sent to his supporters condemning Emanuel's appointment, saying it does not bode well for peace in Israel or for peace activists in general.
Rahm Emanuel is a representative of and really one of the chief architects of a strategy that has moved the Democratic Party from being central liberal to central right. And that is, he has been a primary person who has pushed for a militarist stand in relationship to the Middle East. And the reason for that is his personal connection to Israel and his identification with the right-wing vision of Israel, in which safety and security for Israel will only come if all the other states in the region are considerably less powerful than Israel. Now, I believe that that's a big mistake, both for the United States, which then gets led into struggles that we need not be involved in, like Iraq, but also for Israel, because I don't believe that Rahm Emanuel is actually pro-Israel in a sense. I think he's subjectively pro-Israel, but objectively he's against the interests of Israel, because interests of Israel lie in peace and reconciliation with the Palestinian people, and actually peace and reconciliation with all the countries surrounding them, the possibility of which is evidenced by the recent Saudi plan for a comprehensive peace solution, which was praised just yesterday in the United Nations by the president of Israel, Shimon Peres. So you've got a struggle going on both in the American political world and in the Jewish world between two worldviews, one that sees our security, homeland security in the United States, as dependent upon domination and control and greater power than everyone else, and that seeps over into the Israeli consciousness, and conversely, another view that says that our greatest capacity for homeland security will come when we switch from the failed Bush strategies of domination, control, and militarism to a strategy of generosity and caring for other people. Rahm Emanuel represents the extremes of the anti-caring, anti-generosity strategy. He's somebody who believes that toughness is the key, and you have to be tough with everybody, and that's the only way they'll respect you. So what he represents really is the opposite of what people voted for when they voted for Obama. Whether or not Obama really believed what he said remains to be seen, and certainly the choice of Emanuel does raise some important questions about whether the liberal wing of the Democratic Party was simply tricked by Obama. I hope not, and I don't believe that, but I do believe that this choice is a very disastrous one for both the United States and for world peace.
Rabbi Michael Lerner, it sounds like you're saying that Rahm Emanuel's views regarding the Middle East would basically be a continuation of the Bush strategy. Is that what you're saying?
With minor modification. I think the minor modification is we talk to our enemies, okay? That's very important, to talk to our enemies. But when it comes to the final analysis is, are you talking for the sake of making peace? Are you talking for the sake of warning them that if they don't do what we want them to do, we will make war? There have been both voices coming out of Obama, and because I think both voices are there in Obama. In other words, I don't believe that Obama is just one thing and not the other. I think that he himself has a part of him that's attracted to the tough boy strategy and another one that's attracted to the generosity strategy. Rahm Emanuel is 100% in the tough boy strategy. And what that means concretely is that when you talk to Iran, you don't talk to Iran about finding mutual interest. You talk to Iran and say, look, this is what we need. We need you to stop developing nuclear, anything that could possibly be used for nuclear weapons. And if you don't, we will use our military, or we will encourage Israel to use its military to destroy all the possible places where you might be developing your nuclear capacity. So that's a militarist way of conversation. So it's not the same as Bush, because Bush was for no diplomacy, no talking, and both Emanuel and Obama are for talking. But the question is, what kind of talking? Do you talk in a way that appeals to the hearts of those who are you're talking to, or do you talk with a huge hammer in your hand ready to knock these people out if they don't go with what you want?
Do you see any scenario in which this tough-talking, uncompromising approach could be used to move Israel toward a peace settlement, kind of like Nixon going to China?
I doubt it. I doubt it very much, because we've had a peace process going on for the last 15, 16 years, and the process has yielded very little for the Palestinians and increasing settlements for Israel. And I don't think that Emanuel is going to be a person who is going to say Israel must stop its settlements and withdraw from the West Bank and either get out of those settlements or allow the settlers to remain as citizens of a new Palestinian state. I don't believe that that's what he would do. I think that instead he will make sure that access to the president is restricted to those who continue a middle-of-the-road position, and a middle-of-the-road position has yielded nothing.
That was Rabbi Michael Lerner, editor of Tikkun magazine and chair of the Network of Spiritual Progressives. Call them at area code 510-644-1200 or visit their website at spiritualprogressives.org. Barack Obama's historic election as the nation's 44th president represents a break with the past like few others in American history. As the first African-American occupant of the White House, Obama's election victory almost overnight changed the perception of the United States across the globe. The U.S., viewed widely as an empire in decline, relying increasingly on worn-out ideas and military might to make up for its lack of moral standing, has, with Obama in the White House, now been given a second chance in the minds of many world citizens. Obama won a larger proportion of white votes than any previous non-incumbent Democratic presidential candidate since Jimmy Carter. But Republican candidate John McCain received more votes from white citizens than Obama, by a 12% margin. While Obama won only 41% of the white male vote and 46% from white women, the Illinois senator received the support of 54% of 18 to 29-year-old white voters. This generational shift in changing demographics in the U.S. could portend a more inclusive political future, embracing leadership from America's diverse racial and ethnic population. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Manning Marable, professor of political science and African American studies at Columbia University. He discusses the historic nature of Obama's election and the difficult work ahead for the progressive coalition that put him into office to ensure that the new president responds to their agenda for change.
The fact that only 44 years ago, the majority of African Americans could not exercise their constitutional rights to vote in a presidential election, the fact that it took the Voting Rights Act of 1965 to ensure that a majority of blacks could even vote in this country, and that less than a half century later, the chief executive of the country who was elected is an African American, is an extraordinary victory for democracy. It's an extraordinary statement on, in part, how far we've come as a country. But, of course, we still have a good distance to go before we have social justice or racial fairness. But nevertheless, it's an extraordinary victory. So at one level, I feel terrifically hopeful and tremendously gratified that the sacrifices made by women and men like Fannie Lou Hamer, Ella Baker, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and Medgar Evers were not made in vain, that the fight for democracy and for racial justice in the 1950s and 60s directly contributed to the transformation of American political culture in such a manner that people could begin to judge people not on the basis of the color of their skin, as Dr. King put it, but on the content of their character. We are moving towards such an American society. And with that, I think that's an extraordinary victory for progressive folk, an extraordinary victory for democracy.
Professor Marable, I wanted to ask you about race versus class issues. When Barack Obama was closing his campaign, I think he was very comfortable using issues of populist economics and talking about the big oil companies and John McCain's seven houses. And I think that certainly struck a chord and helped get him across the finish line as the winner of this race. But what do you think about the balance between issues of race and class and the proper balance for Barack Obama as he stops campaigning and actually enters the White House and governs?
Again, this is a real dilemma for him because there is a tension that exists within the Obama victory, that Obama and what he represents is an effort for Americans to transcend the racial divide that I find enormously admirable. It parallels that of Nelson Mandela in South Africa, that Mandela symbolized an effort to reach out across the lines of color and class to allow whites to expiate their own guilt for their compromises with the apartheid system of racial inequality that they lived under for so many decades. Obama represents in his own person the coming together of the DNA of Africa and of Europe, quite literally, so that he personifies that bridge across the line of race. And it's an admirable approach toward the kind of politics we desperately need in the country. My great fear and concern is for the truly disadvantaged, who tend to be disproportionately brown and black, and are their voices being heard? Or with the focus solely on class, does that minimize the particularity and the challenges of race that Latinos and blacks and other people of color experience in this country to this day?
Dr. Mirabel, you're hearing a lot of people, commentators out in the corporate media, talk and warn the Obama administration not to overreach. They've got to rule the country as a center-right nation, which they declare it is still, even after this election and in the 2006 election, where certainly a center-left agenda was winning the day. And there's a lot of the Clinton-era appointees that we're seeing being rolled out, Rahm Emanuel as chief of staff, Hillary Clinton possibly as secretary of state, and a whole cavalcade of other Clinton-era folks. Are we going to see a Clinton presidency number two with the triangulation and the playing constituencies one off the other with the hopes that those who put Barack Obama in office won't raise too much of a ruckus when he tries to cut the baby in half, so to speak?
I think that Obama, by the time we reach January the 20th, we will see that the Clintons and the Clinton forces represent only a very small minority of the forces that will be brought into a new Obama White House. The second question is, how do these constituencies that got him elected, the 95% of all black voters, the 67% of all Latino voters, how do they ensure their concerns get expressed in public policies that are adopted through Congress and are put into motion by President Obama? How do we make sure he's accountable? And that only happens through pressure and through organizing. It's not that Obama is dishonest. It's that he is, just like other politicians, subjected to inordinate pressure from the right to move to the right unless there is a countervailing pressure to push him to be accountable to his own core constituency to carry out the promises he made in his own campaign.
That was Manning Marable, professor of public affairs, political science, history, and African American studies at Columbia University. He is the author of many books, including Living Black History, How Reimagining the African American Past Can Remake America's Racial Future. Visit Dr. Marable's website at manningmarable.net. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced at the studios of WPKN Radio and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines by calling area code 203-331-9756. Or write to Between the Lines, care of WPKN Radio, 244 University Avenue, Bridgeport, Connecticut, 06604. Visit our website at btlonline.org to hear our current and archived programs in MP3 and real audio. There you can subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mika Ta. This week's program was produced by Scott Harris with the assistance of Ruben Abreu, Chris Ferriero, Hank Hoffman, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Denise Manzari.